council business. Today is Monday, 1:00 p.m., March the 12th, and I'd like for... John, could you give us, since our agenda is so packed,
okay,
so why don't we have you give the committee our order of the day?
Okay. Madam Chair and members, I want to refer first to the weekly agenda that is in front of you. Today we actually have three public hearings scheduled. The lion's share of the meeting we expect to be spent on House Bill 5031. This is the budget bill for DHS, and we'll continue with the presentation on public health programs. Towards the end of the meeting, for the last 10 or 15 minutes, we'll have two additional public hearings. One is on House Bill 5032, which is a Senate Bill 333 fee bill, in which the legislature ratifies the fees that were administratively raised during the 2005-07 legislative session. And in addition, there's another fee bill which relates to some statutory fees that are related to public health, House Bill 2193. And with the chair's permission, I've asked public health folks to make short presentations on each of those bills to give you kind of a lay of the land. The rest of the week, you can see on Tuesday, we have public testimony scheduled. Wednesday, March 14th, we have an additional day for the agency to present information about its public health programs. And on Thursday, we'll begin the presentation on the addictions and mental health services within the Department of Human Services. Turning back to today, Madam Chair, we have House Bill 5031 to start things off. Ms. Shibley, Ms. Bradley, and Mr. Mason will be presenting agency information on their particular offices within the public health services area.
Any questions on the agenda for next week as well as today's agenda before we ask people up to join us? And I hope that Ms. Shibley and your group who's coming up with you, you can do that. Please join us. And while she's coming, please note that at 2:15 we want to culminate the conversation regarding her department so that we really, really can do the last portion of our program. And that means that I don't want to cut questions from you at all, but you know, maybe if we can give short questions or short answers. But I don't, if that does not work, I'll understand, because I really do want the committee to not feel as if they're being cut off from asking questions. Ms. Shibley, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I am the administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health in DHS's Public Health Division. It's a delight to be with you today, and with me is Dan Bradley, who, among other things, wears the hat of running the Oak Lodge Water District up in Clackamas County. In the few short minutes that I have before you today, I want to stress a couple of things. And I'm looking now at the tab Environmental Public Health, starting on page 49 of 165 here. You'll see that my office is organized in five different sections. And I also want to refer you to what I hope you may still have from handouts last Friday afternoon when I thought perhaps we'd have an opportunity to talk. One is called the Environmental Public Health Snapshot that I believe is kind of tailor-made for each individual member, so I hope that you have yours. And it gives you an idea of the lens through which we in environmental public health look at your legislative district. Second is a little one-color brochure, Assuring Safe Drinking Water in Oregon, that provides some pretty important information on the largest individual program in my office. And the third actually is a series of of three stories that talks about how environmental public health makes a difference in, for example, Seneca and Grant County, Corbett and Multnomah County, and Mahalem in Tillamook County, just to make real what is sometimes a rather obscure behind-the-scenes kind of effort. So my office is really kind of the seam, if you will, between the health of the environment, how the environment, how people affect the environment, and how the environment affects people. And so we work very, very closely with all of the natural resource agencies. In fact, I sit on the governor's natural resources cabinet and coordinate very closely with them. So we recognize that it's two sides of the same coin. Our environmental and occupational epidemiology section has zero federal funds. Excuse me, zero general funds. It is 100% federal funds. Happy to share more information with you about that. On page 57, our environmental toxicology section has zero general funds. Has 60% other funds and about 40% federal funds, round numbers. And this is a common refrain that you will hear me saying in the next several minutes. In fact, the only general fund that I have in my office is helps raise the necessary state match for our federal funds to protect our drinking water.
Is that a close statement, Ms. Shibley, if I do not cut my schedule?
No.
Is that a cold statement for do not cut my budget?
It's just making sure you're doing it well.
Dollars of money we got.
Although, you know, if you twist my arm, I will take some general funds. It's all right. And that really explains, I guess, why I'm not spending as much time on some of these other sections. Really, what I want to stress with you today is kind of the twin pillars, if you will, of core capacity and health disparities. We have significant capacity issues within environmental public health. And the other thing is that the impact and the consequence of those core capacity deficiencies has a particular disproportionate impact in some parts of the state than others, and in some populations more than others. And, for example, the environmental toxicology section includes the various programs that you see there, including working with owners to rehabilitate drug labs, meth labs. It also helps monitor the ocean water beaches and make sure that people have information when bacterial levels in some waters are higher than health standards suggest or recommend. The general toxicology section I just wanted to spend a minute on, and that is something that is difficult to quantify or categorize because it is so many different things. It is everything from blue-green algae, toxic blue-green algae that threatens concessionaires at various high lakes in central Oregon. It's water reuse applications when somebody wants to use their gray water and use it to irrigate. We need to make sure that water is treated to a high enough level to not be injurious to public health. Shellfish advisories, we work with the Department of Agriculture on mercury in fish, perchlorate in water, off-gassing of mercury in gymnasium floors, you may remember, benzene in the Portland metropolitan area, overall indoor air, PBDE bans, polybrominated dimethylene ethers that the 05 legislature passed, and now biopharmaceutical regulation. Those are just some of the whole variety of issues we deal with, hundreds of them every month on all manner of things, and we have no general funds. We have no funding at all, really, to support that effort. I just want to call your attention to that because that is the sole state resource for public health on so many different environmental concerns, whether it's a school or a church or a business person.
Excuse me, Sugar. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said benzene, and I have recently received some emails about people who have recently discovered coworkers getting cancer, and they're talking about higher percentages of cancer contracted in Oregon than other states, and they're talking about benzene and gas, the way our gasoline has. So what are we doing about that?
Vice Chair Bruin, I wish we were doing more. I wish we could do more, quite honestly. My colleagues over at Department of Environmental Quality have kind of the front line response from a state standpoint. Of course, it's the federal government that deals with kind of the national energy, the national air quality standards. And we within public health are asked to participate as scientific collaborators, not necessarily as frontline responders. We certainly do have some information. Perhaps I can call on Dr. Cohen when he is before you to have some conversation about the impact of benzene on the human body. Excuse me. I'm not going to be the best person to try to quantify that for you, but suffice it to say that our public health toxicologist, if we had one, would be the person who would participate very closely in technical working groups and other kinds of partnerships with DEQ and others to try to address that and keep people safe. At least give people information they know so that they can be as safe as possible. Marcel.
Thank you. We're talking about the fumes from gas, is that right? Okay. I've had a constituent who's been asking me for a while to do something about covering some protective covering. In Oregon, we don't pump our own gas. There are people who stand there all day long and inhale those fumes, as opposed to other states where everybody takes turns inhaling the fumes. So that's an issue that it's too late to address statutorily, but I'm wondering if there can be some protection for the people who do pump gas all day long.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore said that's a terrific point and very important. Within the first section that I mentioned, the environmental and occupational epidemiology, it's exactly that kind of concern that our occupational epidemiology folks are concerned with. We have not identified that specific issue as rising to the top of the entire universe of occupational concerns in the state of Oregon, but I happen to know that it is a very real one indeed. Within our fairly restrictive federal grant on this issue, we are trying to be as creative as possible and leverage that as much as possible by working with private businesses and Liberty Northwest and SAFE and a whole bunch of other folks who care about the health of workers on the job. We know that that's an issue.
That's really good. And I think really on the very serious side, I think that's why it's so important, even though I was teasing the former representative, in terms of making sure that we know that 100% of her budget is federal. That unless the federal government raises that as an issue, they don't have the ability, outside of being real creative in some kind of way, of couching issues of that nature to us, because Oregon does not give them money in this particular area.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking now at page 63, our food, coal, and lodging section, again, that is about 85% paid for by licensees, private business people all over the state through restaurant and lodging, transient lodging, and folks like the good honorable Senator Winters knows quite well the great honor that is to pay licensing fees for food establishments, and about 15% out of federal funds. Again, zero. I will tell you that our Food Service Advisory Committee, which is a statutory advisory committee, actually rather surprised me at their last quarterly meeting when they learned, they told me for the first time that the state of Oregon puts in $0 in food safety, and that they, as licensees, because they represent the majority of the membership on the advisory committee, they pay 100% of it. And so that was the fact that that was news to them told me that it's clearly something that's not known overall. And so I just wanted you to understand that's what the program is, and we work certainly very closely with all of our local health departments in providing all of those services throughout the state. The four sections on page 67, that's our radiation protection services. I just want to mention a couple things about that. From Trojan to tanning beds, as I say, we are the sole, single, only, exclusive public health entity with the expertise and the responsibility and the authority to deal with any and all types and sources of ionizing and non-ionizing radiation. In fact, you'll be hearing about Hospital 2183 here, I hope later on this afternoon, which is a fee-related bill. There is zero general funds in this as well, about 87% other funds, about 13% federal funds. We have statutory fees for service, and we are requesting support for raising those fees in statute. That's 2193. And then we also raised some fees administratively, which we were permitted to do, and that is in our so-called Senate Bill 333 package that you'll be hearing about later today as well. And last but not least, on page 73 is our drinking water program. The drinking water program makes up about a third of my entire office. My office has about 30 programs. One section receives general funds, and really one program receives general fund, which is the drinking water program. And with about 100 people and 30 programs, you know, even a liberal arts major like me can do that kind of math and come quickly to the recognition that we have a lot of one-of programs. We have no managers who only manage. We have managers who manage and then they do the work as well, regardless of their rank in the organization. So we try to be as efficient and productive as we can, and we have a lot of really terrific, well-experienced and educated staff to do that. But this policy option package that you have before you about drinking water really is our very clear, unapologetic statement that we are unable to assure the protection and quality of Oregon's drinking water statewide.
Just a minute, please.
Madam Chair and Ms. Shibley, that's on page 75, is that policy option package?
The policy option package.
10547.
Yes, exactly. Thank you very much. And that package, as you'll note, consists of three categories of dollars. Certainly, the bulk of it is general funds. The other funds piece is, and frankly, the federal funds piece, which is tied to it, are contained really in House Bill 2187, which passed out of Chair Dingfelder's Energy and Environment Committee last week, and actually is headed to the floor. Will not be coming here to Ways and Means, so I certainly encourage your understanding and support for that when it reaches the floor. We have, as I will say, kind of a three-part problem in drinking water, and we need a three-part solution, and this is it. The three-part problem is, number one, we cannot discharge our federally required responsibilities under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act for the current regulations that we have right now for the health standards that are part of the contract that we have with the U.S. Environmental
Protection
Agency.
This committee is assuring you that we will be taking care of Oregonians when it comes to safe drinking water.
Great. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The second piece is we have new regulations that have already started coming from the federal agency, and we have zero capacity to deal with those. And the third piece is that we have on the books in Oregon Revised Statutes 448 a requirement to provide protection and services for the very small systems that aren't large enough to meet the EPA regulation standards, but which start at 15 plus connections. These are the 14 connections. actions in state law, and we have zero capacity. We provide no oversight for anybody that is not an EPA-regulated system. So I want to draw your attention to that very clearly, because we need to make a decision as to whether or not to take that out of statute or to actually discharge our responsibilities under that statute.
Ms. Shelley, I don't know what question you want to ask. That was a powerful statement. That if a system does not qualify under EPA guidelines, mm-hmm. nobody is watching, nobody is investigating, nobody is... Do we know what those areas are in Oregon?
Madam Chair, your first question, that's correct. We certainly, in terms of environmental public health, when we get phone calls from some of those system operators, we take care of them, and as do the counties who are our integral partners. In fact, there was an outbreak or a concern, a suspected outbreak in Benton County recently, and I believe the sanitarium in Benton County itemized how much time they spent to assist. And sure enough, there was a concern. I think it was total coliform in the water, which is kind of bad bugs that you have in the water. And I think they quantified their time at something like $20,000, which they get no money for. We have no money to give them for it. And so we do try to provide that service as it comes to our attention and as we are requested. But in terms of any sort of proactive activity at all, no, number one. Number two, we don't know how many there are. We stopped counting in 1996 when we ran out of money. We stopped counting at 921. We kind of use a plug of about 1,000 systems that we figure are so-called state systems. But the bottom line is we do not know. I guess related to that, you may know that it is state law that when you sell a piece of property that has a private well on it, you're required to have that well checked. We within public health get that well data, and I have literally boxes and cartons of that well data. We have no support or funding or resource to actually input that data and do some checking and cross-checking with our colleagues at DEQ to make sure that those wells are safe.
Wow.
I don't know if it's appropriate to ask questions now or when we have the hearing on the fee bill, so I would just take direction from you, but I have a lot of questions about this and I don't really have any understanding.
We're just trying to manage this time. You represented more than...
Yeah.
Madam Chair, probably be good to ask those questions when we work on that particular bill.
Okay.
Although we're not working it today, Representative Morgan, we're just having a public hearing on.
Yeah, but it would. I don't want to bog down the unfolding of the agenda, so I'm very happy to wait until we have the hearing on the bill.
So when you schedule this again, make sure Ms. Shibley is here for a fee bill, so that people can ask generalized, specific questions at that particular time. Is that okay? So we'll just schedule it when we do the fee bill, and you will be here to answer questions.
Madam Chair, it'd be my pleasure. I'll end at that, and Mr. Bradley was kind enough to take time out of his work. He is one of about the 3,600 public utility operators who helps provide our safe drinking water around the state. You may think that this is my bottle of water. Actually, this is an example of if every Oregonian paid the equivalent of this bottle of water per biennium, that's the amount that we are requesting, and we could ensure safe drinking water around the state. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to turn over to Mr. Bradley.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Bradley. I'm the general manager of Oak Lodge Water District, which is a retail distribution system between the cities of Gladstone and Milwaukee, and I'm also the general manager of the North Clackamas County Water Commission, which is a treatment plant that is on the Clackamas River that's owned collectively by Sunrise Water Authority, which is Damascus Happy Valley area, the city of Gladstone, and Oak Lodge Water District, and that serves about 80,000 people. I am a member of the Drinking Water Advisory Committee, and so I've been hearing about this, and I've been on the committee since the mid-80s. Pretty soon I'll get smart and kick me off, but for right now I'm still on it. And what I would like to say that what Gail says is completely accurate. In the municipal water provider's eyes, this program has never been fully funded. When it started in the mid-80s, we took it or got taken away from Environmental Protection Agency, which we saw as a very good thing. The reason we see it as a very good thing is EPA is pretty much strictly enforcement, whereas the drinking water program is supportive in terms of education, of training, of helping especially smaller systems that don't have the knowledge or maybe not have seen it before, but they can expose them to what other places do so they can get an idea how to do things correctly. So I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have. Otherwise, I'm just here to support the drinking water program.
Questions?
Time. Would you indulge me? I'm not really clear in my head where the dividing line is here on what's regulated and what's unregulated. Can you help me understand that a little bit better?
Adam Perry, Representative Morgan. When the program started in the 80s, I believe we were testing for about 15 different contaminants. And the big one would have been bacteriological for E. coli and those sort of things. We're up to 97 now. We're at the point we call them, instead of acronyms, we call them CLSNs, chemicals with long and scary names, because a lot of us don't even know what they are. But we still have to test for them. EPA sets what the contaminants are and the level that they have to be, that you have to meet and be lower than. That is passed down then to the drinking water program, essentially to run the program and do the enforcement. So there's also, up until 1996, every 3 years, EPA had to develop 25 new contaminants to be tested. With the 96 amendments to the Safe Drinking Water Act, we got that changed. But there still is a list of what they call unregulated contaminants that some of us medium to large systems still test for to see if they are in the system. So there's the fully regulated contaminants, and like an R, a medium size runs from 3,300 connections up to, or 3,300 population to about 100,000. We've got four systems that are 100,000 and bigger, and then the smaller systems are typically at a different testing stage than the large always get hit first. In our case, it would be like Portland, Salem, 12 Valley Water District. There, as soon as those contaminants come out, they're on the shortest time frame to get it set up to take the samples, get them analyzed, and determine what levels they're at. Then the medium systems kick in and do the same thing. So it's an ongoing, continuous thing for us in terms of regulating contaminants.
So who are the unregulated people in all of this?
Right, Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, the four connections to 14 connections are in state statute. EPA only recognizes 15 connections and above.
So these are very small water systems that serve less than 15 hookups.
I live just outside of Silverton. My neighbors, there's four houses that share a well. They would be some that would be helped. Right now they're not doing anything other than drinking out of the well.
So would the standard way to look at this would be people that share a well or share a spring or something like that? Is that what we're talking about here?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, it's not necessarily what their source is. It's how many are connected to the same source. Certainly, if it's a surface water source with a spring, they're going to be subject to probably far more, especially bacteriological contamination, than four systems or four connections to a well. Typically, wells aren't nearly as subject to contamination. Actually, groundwater does not have to be chlorinated. So it varies amongst all of them. I hope I'm actually accurately here.
So am I correct in assuming, again, I'm skipping ahead to House Bill 5032, that do the fees in this bill apply to those small water systems?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, those fees are for certified operators. That's one fee, and then the other one is plan review. I don't have the language here right in front of me in terms of that bill. The operator certification, that is required under U.S. EPA. So if you're not a U.S. EPA system, you don't have to meet that requirement. The same with the the review of the plans. Part of the reason why we do not know how, where or how many state systems there are is that we have no interaction with them. So they would not be part of our system, so to speak. I hope that that's responsive to you.
So make sure I understood what you said. Did you say that some of these fees apply to those very small systems and some of them don't?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, I believe that's a great question, and I will make sure that I'm answering it correctly, but I believe that the different certification levels, so the operator certification on lines 9 through 20-something there, they only pertain to EPA systems, which is 15 connections and above.
Okay, and if I might, I'm just floating up straight in the dark here, so trying to figure this out.
Well, I was equally as shocked, and I looked at them and I said, where are all our unions? Aren't you guys saying something here?
So these are all new fees that are not in place. Are these increases in fees that are currently in place?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, the latter is correct. Those two fees are the only two, actually those three types of fees. It's crop backflow prevention, so that your gray water doesn't get into your tap water. It's operator certification, so that the operator who's running the plant has appropriate training, and its review of the physical plant plans. Those are the three types of fees that we currently have in statute. They have not been changed since 87 and 83, I think, for OPCERT and for plan review. And so those are all three of them are existing. To answer your question, all three of them are existing. 2187, which I mentioned before, is a new fee, and that is a sanitary survey fee, quote unquote, for on-site inspections of systems.
Just a moment, let me consider that, John.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Morgan, the fees that are listed in House Bill 5032 are Senate Bill 333 process fees. That is, the agency is allowed to increase those fees and has done so during the current biennium, 2005-07. The legislature, as you know, has to ratify those fees, and that's what House Bill 5032 is. Ms. Shibley is distinguishing those fees from ones that are included in House Bill 2187, which are, as I understand it, new fees. So these are current existing fees that the agency can administratively raise. 2187 has fees that are currently do not exist.
And where's 2187 in the mix?
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, it has been heard in another House, different House committee, and I think it has been referred to Joint Ways and Means, but I'm not positive of that.
Senator Carter, Mr. Britton, it was indeed in front of Chair Dingfelder's House Energy and Environment Committee. It passed out of that committee unanimously and is going to the floor, carried by Representative Jensen. Legislative Fiscal is going to work very closely on the reshoot issue because, as Mr. Britton may know, there are some kind of concerns to make sure we've got all the numbers exactly right on that 47, I believe, is the policy option package.
If I might, Madam Chair, it would help me understand this more if I could see the field that we're playing in, I think. And so if it is possible to request information about what the fees were before they were put in this bill, I think that would help understand a little bit. And if we could also get a bead on where I can see Mr. Britton's thinking ahead here. But, and I don't. 2187 appears to be something that we aren't going to get a look at in this committee. So I think that it would be a good thing to see where we were before this started.
And Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, I've asked the agency when we have the hearing on 5032 to show you a chart showing you what the current fee is and what the proposed fee is and the impact on the revenue.
In answer to your question about rural areas, I think the key here is in this number of connections. A lot of people in the rural areas have their own water system, and so they're the only family using it. And in some cases, two or three families may use something, but it would be rare in the area where I live to have more than one or two on a system. Now, where you find a system is something like in Arch Cape in my district, or you know, some of these smaller towns, Cannon Beach, Westgate, Manzanita, they'll have their own water system, and they would then be involved with this sort of regulation.
Okay, that's going to be Representative Bernard, Representative Kotek, and then Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of the fees that you have listed, as an example, well logging, is normally done by the Water Resources Department. Is that who is getting this increase, or is your department getting this increase?
Madam Chair, Representative Gore, I'm sorry, I'm not following exactly where you are looking.
Oh, I'm just looking at your fee request. Page 3, line 34.
5032, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, well logging is done by Water Resources, and they have the responsibility for doing that. I'm wondering how you're getting a $1,376 fee out of that.
Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, you may know, I hope I'm not misspeaking here, and I'm sure Mr. Kuhlman can help correct this. This is through our radiation protection services. And you'll notice that it includes, I believe, let's see if I can follow this all the way up here now. I believe it starts on line 38 of page 2. And Madam Chair, I'm happy, since this is only a public hearing today, I believe, I'm happy to log all these questions and make sure you have the answers when this bill comes back.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Shibley, could you provide a history? I assume you haven't had a general fund increase in a while, or it's been very gradual. I'm just wondering what the general fund history is for just the water portion of your budget.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I believe we did get, I don't want to minimize it, a few additional dollars in the 05-07 legislatively approved budget. Our general fund for this biennium is about 1.3, I think I'm looking over here to Bass and Bam to see if he may have the number off the top of his head. And that number has been about the same for quite some time. I couldn't give you the number. I'm happy to provide that history by biennium if you'd like.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. Thank you. That would be helpful, because I would assume, like most things, they passed the new federal laws in 86, and now we have new ones, and we probably haven't kept up along the way, so that might be helpful. Convincing point to say, you know, if we're going to meet the regulations that we've had in place for 20 plus years, we should have some corresponding funding for it. Thank you.
The other question I have relates to the bottle of water that you put up there, and your statement that the cost of implementing, I believe it was this bill, would be less per person than the cost of the bottled water.
Representative Morgan, Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, yes, although I'll tell you that the price of this keeps going up, so my math, it used to be that I could say that, and now I can't seem to find any that's about a dollar, but actually it's the entire package that we are requesting, which is around $3 million, which includes the rest of the federal funds, which we can't generate enough state match right now to take all the federal funds that we have available. The new fee bill, the sanitary survey fee bill, which is 2187, which is the OF portion of that policy option package, and the general fund increase. That total amount is about three-something million. There are about 3.6 million Oregonians in the state. And so if this were worth a dollar, that's where
that's
I'm getting
at. Okay,
exactly.
Well, but let me give you a little bit of a perspective, a different perspective on that. I have in my district, in my legislative district, a number of very small water districts that provide less than 100 people. And they have plants where they purify the water and they test and they do all those kinds of things. But one of the things that they're very sensitive to is that they don't have a lot of people to spread the costs of the permits out. And so it quickly gets to the stage where if their permitting fees go up, then they suddenly don't have any money in their capital construction account to do repairs on the system and things like that. So it would be very helpful to try to gauge what the relative impact of this is on the users of the system, because there is no option but to pass the cost on to the subscribers of the system. If we had some kind of information to know which ones of these permits would apply to which operations, and if there's any way to approximate by the size of the districts which ones of these fees they would need to pay.
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, you raised several good points. I won't try to take up the committee's time to respond to each of them now, but I know, because my office works with so many small business people in every single program, just how important it is to be mindful of and work with what are the fiscal realities of a small business person. I think I can speak for Mr. Bradley and other members of the Drinking Water Advisory Committee who help us prioritize our workload and who approve or not discussions about if or how much and when to increase any fees. You notice they haven't been increased in 25 years. We're very mindful of that. And so that piece aside, I'm happy to provide you some additional information related to 5032.
And don't you have federal revolving loan funds for people like that? So maybe you can put Representative Morgan in touch with that kind of thing. Because her concern would be how would they, if there were problems, how would they fix those problems without trying to bear the personal expense of this? And so with your federal revolving loan fund, maybe that might be an area and you can give her further information on that. One more question, Representative Morgan, then Senator Winters.
Well, and if I might, Madam Chair, the revolving loan funds mostly revolve around capital construction projects, and so they really aren't available for regulatory type things. But I think just to make the point once again that a fee increase is a very different animal when you have a large municipal water service where you can spread the cost of the fee out over thousands and thousands of subscribers than it is when you've got the same fee and you're spreading it out under less than 100 subscribers. And that's the point that I'm trying to bring forward.
Madam Chair, if I might just, I forgot to mention one other handout that I provided the committee on Friday that is a printout of a PowerPoint that I provided to, I think, from then Chair Morissette's interim committee. And one of those slides includes this kind of pie chart that shows how many and what size public water systems we have in the state. And you notice the one that says zero right here are those over 100, serving over 100,000. And this 86% are those that serve 3,300 to 10,000. So I'm very mindful of what the so-called smaller, medium-sized systems like Mr. Bradley's, what it means to them, because that is most of the water systems in the state of Oregon.
Well, and I think it would be some kind of an analysis of the impact of these fees on those different classes of water districts.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up on the question that Representative Kotek asked about the general fund and ask for kind of a history. Would you include other federal funds so that you have a global overall picture? Because if you just do one without the other, you don't get a true history. And I'd like to go a little bit, because you mentioned backflow and the fee. Can you differentiate between the backflow, that fee for the department versus the backflow that counties and cities require, because all counties and cities also require backflow permits and uses, and it would be nice to know the difference in the uses of those funds.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Winters, it's the same program.
It's the same program?
The cities are just implementing the state rules from Chapter 333.
So when I have to pay someone to come out to my home to inspect my backflow every year?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, it's a state law, and actually the reason that they're tested annually is because a lot of times they're on irrigation systems and that sort of thing, so they're used intermittently. Sometimes they freeze, and so the check valves actually crack and break, and so they're tested to make sure that nothing can come back into the domestic system.
So this fee is not going into Gales?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, it does for the certification fee. They run the certification program, just like our operator certification program, to where those fees go in, we get the renewals back in our certifications, and with that, we have to ensure that we've gotten enough education units over a period of time that we're current with what new regulations and those sort of things are, and so that's what they ensure with the certification program.
So, question, how many certifiers do we have in the state?
Oh, wow.
Madam Chair, Senators, I will get you that information. I do not know off the top of my head.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I could ask your indulgence for an interruption for a very honored and honorable guest who I believe, Madam Chair, you may have suggested drop by to speak a bit about her experience with public health. Representative Jean Catlin has been, until recently, a member of the state's Public Health Advisory Board. She was no longer eligible to continue once she stepped into her current status. And it's a great pleasure to allot a few minutes for her to make some comments. Thank you.
Welcome, colleague.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jean Cowan. I'm a representative from House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast. And I really appreciate your indulgence. If I could back you up just a little bit to your discussion last week regarding public health, Mercifully, I don't have any prepared testimony, and I will only take a few moments. But I really thought it necessary that I enter into the record my strong support for the proposed increases in the public health infrastructure that you were talking about. This is a critical need that just simply can't be overlooked. As most of you know, I'm a newcomer to the legislative process, but my history is 12 years as a Lincoln County Commissioner, and during that time I was the chair of the Local Government Advisory Group for the Department of Human Services, as was mentioned, a member of the Public Health Advisory Board, and active in the Association of Oregon Counties, where my primary specialty area was public health and mental health during that time. The core capacity and the local public health programs became very near and dear to me, and it's something that I felt like we needed to talk just a little bit about. It was mentioned earlier by Ms. Shibley that counties are the integral partners in much of our public health delivery system. And so that's where I'm really concerned about reducing the disparities from one county to the next and that ability to provide that core service. And I share that concern with our county public health directors, who I suspect you have heard from, and I see some folks representing them behind me here today. There's a genuine concern out there about our ability to respond to whatever the emergent situation might be, and that can so easily overwhelm our county public health departments. Communicable disease control is the heart of every public health system, but it's usually sort of invisible. It generates very little attention because as long as we don't have a problem, nobody notices that it's there. But in the 12 years that I was a commissioner, I watched these relatively minor little events just sort of overwhelm our system in no time and take everybody off of their regular daily responsibilities of seeing to the safety of the citizens in our community. So bolstering that capacity is just a critical need that I really can't overstate and something that we've been overlooking for some time in bringing some additional help to our localities and reducing the disparity and helping to be sure that we protect the health of every single individual in our community is really very critical. So that's what I wanted to get into the record today. Certainly if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them, but I appreciate your intentions.
Thank you, Representative Callan. Any questions, Representative Callan? Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
Ms. Catherine Bradley.
Chair Carter and committee, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health, and it's my pleasure to provide a brief overview for you of the office, beginning on page 77 of your notebooks. The Office of Family Health administers programs directed at improving the health of Oregon's women, children, and families through preventive health program and services and addressing population issues specifically around health disparities. The major programs that are in my office are immunization, nutrition and health screening, better known as WIC, reproductive health, adolescent health, and maternal and child health. In terms of our funding background, our GRB for our office is approximately $274 million, of which 6% or approximately $17 million is general fund. And of that, 86% or $253 million is what goes to county payments. There were some questions last week about major funding sources. For our office, our major funding sources federally are USDA, which funds WIC, Title 10 and Title 19, which predominantly fund family planning, CDC and through CDC, a vaccine for children's program that funds immunization, and then Title 5 federally, which funds maternal child health. We also do have match dollars that were, that question was also asked last week. At the state level, we do matching for school-based health centers, administratively for immunization to expand our funding pool and for family planning. And at the county level, we do a significant match in terms of our FPEP family planning program, which has a 90-10 match, and Babies First, which is a home visiting program, which does a 60-40 match under targeted case management. I just wanted to briefly highlight a couple of things on our programs and then answer any questions you might have. On immunizations, which starts on page 79, the intent of that is obviously that we don't have any Oregonians that suffer from vaccine-preventable disease. Last year, our office distributed over 16 million vaccines to public and private providers. In Oregon, about 87% of our vaccinations occur through private providers. And the question was raised about the performance measure, which you will find on page 80, which it is a concern. I think we have an exceptional immunization program in the state, but one of the true challenges we do have is around our immunization program. The performance measure number 22 is the percentage of 2 to 3 year olds who are appropriately immunized, and I do have a copy of our immunization schedule to pass out to you. What I wanted to highlight for you is that we are doing a tremendous amount of work in this area, which you'll see with the schedule. Ms. King has a copy of that, is that in a period of time, for those of you who are a little bit maybe distant from the immunization schedule, the 4-3-1-3-3 are the sequence of vaccines that need to occur. The two that we have the most significant problem with are actually with varicella, which is for chickenpox, and the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis,
vaccination, which occurs between the second and third year. Those are the two areas that we have the most significant challenge with right now, and we have an active program on that.
Katie did hand them out.
Oh, she did. Great. So you have a copy of this schedule. The biggest issue that we have, I think, in terms of addressing this right now is we have a campaign where we're trying to work with providers and families in terms of reminding them about the need for the immunizations. We use our alert registry to assess it at a county level and at a provider level. Annually, we actually are able to meet with each of our providers and talk with them about how they're doing in terms of their vaccination rates, as well as provide that at a county level. And we have a new process in terms of reminder and recall notices that we're testing out with the public. So we're trying to address this across a number of different facets, although we continue to be concerned that we're not where we need to be in Oregon. Any questions before I move further?
I'm just overwhelmed by your numbers and where we are in the nation and how we're still trying to get immunizations to kids. And it's like I have 50,000 questions in my head. Any questions? Representative Morgan.
There has been, and I know you're aware of this, discussions in the amongst the counties that are going to lose secure rural schools funding because of how they're going to cope with the match that they put into programs in the human services arena. And I did have some discussions around the immunization program. And I'm curious about who, for the public health clinics, who pays for the immunizations themselves, the cost of the serums?
Chair Carter and Representative Morgan, Oregon actually receives federal funding through CDC and then through the Vaccines for Children's program that actually allows us to cover the cost of vaccine. It doesn't necessarily cost the administrative component of that, but the cost of vaccination and the $16 million that we used to distribute vaccine across the state last year come from those federal programs.
So the counties then that receive the vaccine at no cost, but disseminating it is where their cost comes in.
Chair Carter and Representative Morgan, yes. So the fact that we're able to provide coverage for the vaccine cost, personnel cost, and the administration of that is a county-level responsibility, as it is in the private provider's office as well.
So if the counties then are thrown into a situation where they're unable to put their share of the cost into the program, what happens?
Chair Carter and Representative Morgan, I think that certainly is one of the concerns we have right now with the fragileness of the county health systems and the concern over the timber tax cuts. The funding that we've tried to do with pulling down all of the federal funding we have possible, as well as the fact that one of the efficiencies you'll notice in the immunization program is that we identified a mechanism about how to bill for third-party payers, and that actually has netted us an additional $2 million that we've put back into vaccine. So I think we've tried to maximize whatever we can at the federal level. We do not have any additional funding, though, that we really have available to offset that for the county level.
Have you identified what the impact will be in terms of the match that you'll lose out on?
We will. As Representative Morgan, we're going to invite Mr. Folks here with us tomorrow to talk about the impact of those. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here this afternoon. I'd like to go to the text on page 77 in the description of what the Office of Family Health is set up to accomplish. And there's a statement here that says the Office of Family Health also reduces and eliminates disparities and provides technical assistance, etc. I'd like to know exactly what does this statement mean, the phrasing around also reduces and eliminates disparities. What does this mean? What is it that you do to reduce and eliminate disparities? And what disparities are being referenced here? I want to make sure I'm understanding the use of the term here. And the statement is also written to suggest that you've had success. Again, it says the Office of Family Health also reduces and eliminates.
So could you elaborate, please, on what it is you want us to understand about what you do in this regard?
Okay. Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, thank you very much. I think our office takes very seriously their responsibility to the Oregonians that are dealing with health disparities or any other areas, because really as a state agency, that is one of our primary responsibilities. It really sort of is addressed across different programs. So, for example, in immunization, this last year we produced a booklet, actually not a booklet, a notebook, that we've actually distributed to all the private providers that was 2 years in development about how to be more culturally appropriate and how to reach out to different health disparities, different populations that they may be seeing. And we worked across a very large group in terms of doing that. With our RIC program, if you look at the clients that we see there, we work very heavily with the Latina and African American population in terms of doing specific targeting with our materials, with our education components, so that we're really trying to constantly address that. In all of our programs, we have bilingual staff that are specific to particular program components where we really need to have that addressed. In maternal child health, we also are doing things across different populations at a county level, working with the specific counties that have different Latino and African American populations, migrant health clinics. So I guess from our perspective, that is really the core of the work that we do with the families, the parents that we need to address across all of our populations. Family planning is another that we've had very specific targeting and continue to have very targeted outreach activities, adolescent health in our school-based health centers. Again, I think it's replicated across the type of materials, the education materials, and the specific program elements that we have that address these, and we work with community members and county members as well to address that.
Follow-up. Where would I look to see evidence of, again, the statement that's here that says the Office of Family Health also reduces and eliminates disparities? Where would I look to see evidence that there is targeting of populations going on, data collection, something that shows trends and changes and differences as a result of the work that you're describing and defining?
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, we'd be happy to produce that material for you. We actually not recently, about a month and a half ago, for Dr. Goldberg's office, actually pulled together a listing of all the work that we've been doing across our offices. But I think the real question you're asking is what has been the impact, and we'd be glad to do a little additional work with that and provide that to this committee, because I think that's an important question.
Okay. Again, I am pushing, because the language is active language.
It is.
You're reducing and eliminating. So where's the evidence? That's what I'm asking for. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions?
Thanks. Thank you very much. Moving forward on page 86, we have our nutrition and health screening program with WIC. This provides nutrition education and counseling to low-income and postpartum and breastfeeding women and to children under the age of 5. Last year, we served over 166,000 women and children. It's important to understand what a critical program this is in Oregon. 40% of all infants in the state and over 51% of infants in rural counties are served by WIC. In general, we look at it as 1 in 3 Oregon children under the age of 5 benefit from WIC services. It's also a significant economic driver at the county level, providing over $59 million in grocery dollars at the county. And then an additional $1 million through our farmer market program, which serves both WIC families and seniors. The most notable thing I think that we're getting a lot of attention and we feel very pleased with across the state is the fact that Oregon continues to lead the nation in women who choose to breastfeed at 89% of initiation. This is going to result, we think, predominantly of the fact that the WIC program has purchased breast pumps and has them available at no cost as a loan program, so that for low-income women there is absolutely no obstacle to breastfeeding. We have other legislation in place, working with the Women's Coalition about trying to remove
workplace barriers to that, because there is a concern that by 6 months we have dropped 27%. And the exclusive breastfeeding is the concept that all children should be breastfed up to the age of 6 months, and that's what we're trying to promote in the state. But Oregon does continue to be a leader in this area that we take a lot of pride in. Again, it's really the driving of the WIC clinics at the local level that's really made that possible. I will draw to your attention that we do have a POF asking for increased funding for the WICS Farmers Market Program to increase the food checks given for purchasing fruits and vegetables, and this would take it from the current $20 to $30 for the season, and it approximates $100,000, and it's on page 90.
One question. I was looking at the summary of health indicators, and some, let's say, from 1997 to this year, 2007, how have you increased the number of low birth weight babies that maintain life as opposed to those that died? Because I know that back in the 80s, we were down equivalent to the state of Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And if you can just give me a little more today, I would appreciate that.
I can give you a partial answer to that, Chair Carter and committee, and then I think I'd like to give you something a little bit more detailed that our epidemiologists had weighed in on.
Okay.
Oregon's rate of low birth weight has been low. I do think it is some of the programs such as WIC that we've been extremely effective, as well as our home visiting programs that focus very tightly on prenatal care and other partnerships with our larger community. The other component of that, in all honesty, is that Oregon has a predominantly Caucasian population, and a Caucasian population has less of an issue in terms of health disparities. But I'll address that more specifically with a review by our MCH epidemiologist.
Please, thank you.
I'd like to continue with our reproductive health program. Our reproductive health program starts on page 93. These are services that are focused on individuals under 250% FPL, providing services to over 156 different clients in 165 clinics across Oregon last year. It is important to notice that of the clients served, 72% were under 100% of the federal poverty level, and so this continues to be a distinct population, that this is a unique service that's critical to receive. Our performance measure has indicated that we've had quite a bit of success with this, and the power behind this really has been the family planning expansion program here for Oregon, where we have had a 9-to-1 match, which gives us an incredible capacity to draw down federal funding that really has expanded this. The biggest impact that we have felt this last year with a number of other DHS programs has been the impact of the DRA. That's a specific concern to this population, that issues of identity and issues of enrollment procedure and any obstacles that prevent someone who stops in to get their initial checkup and to get birth control pills has really been a problem.
Excuse me.
Just a question. I've been gone for a little bit, and so alphabet soup, you're going to have to speak and let me know when you say DRA. I'm probably the one on this panel that would like to use plain English when we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Carter and Senator Winters, I actually appreciate the reminder. Thank you. So the Deficit Reduction Act, which has required the identity requirements, has been particularly hard hit on this population, and we do have a lot of concern working with our agencies about the long-term implications of this. We do have a program evaluation piece that we're working with our counties on to understand this over time, but that is a significant aspect. We do have a POP that has been recommended for this population, and that can be seen on page 96. It is for $2.5 million for additional funding. It's package 90 for reproductive health, and the predominant impact is to increase provider reimbursement rates for the project, which have not changed since 2001, and also is going to be targeting specific populations that we've identified that need additional outreach. Thank you.
If there aren't any questions, I'll move ahead with adolescent health.
Please do.
Okay. With our adolescent health program, this actually is a fairly multifaceted program, and while we're going to predominantly focus here on the school-based health centers, I do want to mention that we do have a very active coordinated school health program with our partners in the Department of Education, teen pregnancy prevention program, and a nutrition and physical activity component to this program. Our school-based health centers, as our partner spoke to last week, has really been a very fundamental component of Oregon's safety net system and has been supported well for over the last 20 years. We do have 44 certified centers in 17 counties that currently serve over 20,000 children and have provided over 64,000 visits in this last year. We have two additional centers which are in the planning stages. It's important to notice in the documents provided to you that of the children seen last year, 42% are uninsured, 28% have public health insurance. So this really does function as a very strong safety net in our current system. On page 100, you can see information about our distribution of clients. What I think I'd like to do is just briefly move over to the POP expansion, because I think that's been of particular interest, and that you will find over on page 104, that for our school-based health centers, there is a recommendation for expansion of 2 million that would allow the expansion to 6 more counties, and 7 existing counties could expand also. Their planning process. We do maintain a list of the state of communities that have requested an interest in terms of moving forward with school-based health centers, and it is an activity that occurs with multiple planning and is very community-driven, and we'd like to see the opportunity for this to continue.
A couple of questions, because you're going rather fast. Back to page 102, really looking at statistics, are very good, except in the area of dental preventive care in Stevenson, what have you, and is there any plan to try to improve those numbers? Looking at mental health assessment, we're down, and if there's plans to improve those numbers. And personally, I would like to have a copy or some information of those communities who would like to have school-based clinics.
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, we would be happy to provide that information. We have continued to work closely with the governor's office in terms of their awareness also of expansion. These numbers here are reflected, the oral health issues I'll speak to in a minute a little bit more thoroughly, and maternal child health. And we do have very active work going on in the state from our oral health program in terms of both dental sealants and fluoride activities with our home visiting program. But these are reflective of Oregon's problems that they have with their smile survey, so if I could speak to that in a minute.
Excuse me just for a minute. I have a management problem now, and so what I'd like to do is to have you to come back on Wednesday and start at the maternal child health. And I apologize to I know your name, Mr. Mason, James Mason, that we're going to have to take your names here too, because this was a robust and I think very needed conversation today, and I did not want the committee not to be able to ask pertinent questions to this issue of water and your issue as well. So you can finish answering Senator Winters' questions, and then what we will do is have that completed, and you and Mr. Mason will come back on Wednesday.
Senator Winters, then in response to that, just to sort of complete the concept, in terms of dental health, we are very active in the state right now with a dental health sealant program that has been largely funded by the CDC. It has enabled us to work in communities that have schools that 50% or more have a free lunch. And so we've had a very targeted approach to that, and I can have the numbers available to you and those communities as well, because we've had that noted. And we have a POP in relationship to that to do some additional funding so that we can continue at a community level to work with the communities to build sustainable programs that they can partner with their schools.
It's very important that the dental, the hygiene and those issues also will correlate with some of the other physical issues. And so I think sometimes we forget about the mouth and how it plays with the rest of the health and the body. So it would be nice to see those included.
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, we are in absolute agreement of that. And I believe that from the oral health program perspective, everything is driven because of interest through the mouth. And just a moment of comment about the mental health component. We actually did get a grant this last year that is beginning to partner mental health components with several of our school-based health centers because we are well aware of the risks that are in particular of the adolescent population and additional work that we want to do in that arena. So we are working in that as well. Thank you.
Look forward to seeing you on Wednesday.
Well, Madam Chair,
one other question.
I do want to go back to your earlier question, Madam Chair, about the summary of health indicators. You asked a particular question about low birth weight. When you come back, if you could please be prepared to speak to us through, disaggregate the data for us. Disaggregated data is a diagnostic tool. It tells us how we're doing with all populations. And when you present general pictures, it's an incomplete picture. And so I'd appreciate you doing that. And would appreciate the data being presented in that manner for all of the programs that you are representing through the Office of Public Family Health. And Dr. Allen has already heard on previous occasions that that's an issue and concern for those of us who serve on mm-hmm. health and human services. And if we could just get into the practice of presenting our information in that manner, it would, again, just provide a much more detailed and meaningful picture about how we're doing as a state and how we're doing in terms of addressing the needs of all of our populations. We'd appreciate that.
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, we would be happy to do that. That's the way we function internally, and we'll do a better job of presenting that to the committee and to the rest of Oregon as well.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Britton? Close the hearing on House Bill 5031 and open the hearing on House Bill 5032.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Coolum, the Deputy Director for Public Health Division. I'm here to testify on House Bill 5032, which we refer to as an omnibus fee bill for the Public Health Division fees. House Bill 5032 will approve or sanction the Public Health Division to continue with certain fees that have been established over the course of the 2005-2007 interim legislative session. The fees listed in this bill have been established or increased through the administrative rules process as outlined by the Department of Administrative Services and have been approved by DAS as having followed those procedures. Prior fee levels of these programs are not sufficient to cover the costs associated with carrying out essential service levels, responsibilities, and increased workloads for the programs. The fee levels proposed in 5032 will enable the Public Health Division programs to provide timely reviews, inspections, and certifications to those areas which do affect health outcomes by all of all Oregonians by reducing risks and improving the quality of service of those who pay the fees. The primary program areas affected by these proposed fees are the drinking water program, which you heard earlier from Administrator Gail Shibley, the medical marijuana program, Radiation Protective Services, and the Office of Multicultural Health, Healthcare Interpreters. Very quickly, the drinking water program fees associated with 5032 include water operator certifications, which are typically based upon the certification levels and are generally paid for on behalf of the operator by a water system. These fees have not been adjusted since 1987. Cross-connection, which again is assessed by public water systems, usually is based upon the level of service or the number of service connections. This is, was a newly established fee that was enacted as part of the 2005 legislature. Plans review, which are typically paid by water systems, engineering firms, or developers, are for the types of plans, that is, for example, master plans, storage plans, water treatments, disinfections, corrosions, the like, and these fees have not been adjusted since 1981. All fees associated with the drinking water program do contribute to the state match that is collectively required to retain and maximize our federal funds under the Environmental Protection Agency, otherwise known as Primacy. And by retaining Primacy, Oregon is then able to secure the state revolving loan fund. The medical marijuana program, these fees are paid for by new applicants and renewal applicants for a medical marijuana card. These fees were initially decreased back in January of 2005 to $55, but were then readjusted back to the $100 level when House Bill 5077 redirected program cash balance for other shortfalls of the department. Radiation Protective Services. These fees associated include licensees for entities which require gamma spectroscopy analysis. And what this is basically grain analysis that applies to the export and import of grain shipments. Since Chernobyl, many countries now require that this analysis be done on shipments coming to and through their ports for security reasons. In 2006, our radiation protection tested approximately 36 shipments from ports such as Singapore, Bangladesh, Lebanon, and United Arab Emirates. The fee for this particular service was last adjusted in 1994. And lastly, under radiation protection, the radioactive materials licensing fees are paid for by licensed users of radioactive materials. Typically, these materials are found in medical therapy, universities, colleges, industrial and manufacturing plants, hospitals, laboratories, or clinics. These fees were last adjusted in 1993. And then lastly, the Healthcare Interpreter Office of Multicultural Health. This is a fee for the registry, qualification, and certification of applicants who provide interpreter services regarding healthcare issues for patients whose primary language or whose first language is not English. My public health division colleagues who are also present and I are pleased to answer any of your questions, and we certainly welcome and thank for your support on House Bill 5032.
Representative Morgan.
I'm still digesting.
Mr. Bargessi, Rex Agar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill, I learned a long time ago in running my radio stations and looking at rate increases for advertising that if I gave a rate increase, a little bitty one every year, my advertisers didn't object nearly as much as if I waited 2 or 3 years between rate increases. Why on earth have you waited so long to raise these fees?
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, that is an excellent question. I think the program might be able to give you more specific detail. In large part, I think in general, the programs have tried to be very fiscally responsible in not asking for a fee if they didn't need it, and through the expansion of the particular program, such as radiation area, where there may have been a explosion, if you will, of different radioactive materials and such, but as the program began to collect fees and could absorb their operating costs through those revenues, they have done so. But now it has come to the point where they can no longer continue with the fee that they're presently charging.
But some of the fees are increased 300%. As a matter of fact, most of them are over 100%. That somebody's not figuring very well looking at the future.
Representative Duarte, As to the appropriateness or the level of an individual fee, I believe that the programs have worked very closely with their constituents that are affected by the fees in either public hearing or work groups to agree upon a fee schedule that would be supportive of them.
One follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
You believe or that actually happened?
I'm sure that that has happened in almost all instances where we've had a proposed fee increase. Because as part of the administrative rule process, they have to hold a public hearing of the affected payers.
Thank you.
That's right. Representative Cortez?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So should we assume that for lines that didn't have a current fee, how are they funded? And was that out of the goodness of the heart of the department? Or particularly the last page, we're looking at the interpreter registries and certification.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, that is because the enabling legislation for the healthcare interpreters just passed last biennium. So they would have been working in this interim period with which to go through the administrative rules process, have the hearings of the affected fee payers, and then adopt the rule by which they would then start assessing it. So it is that particular one is a very fee.
And follow up? On the water ones? That's very helpful for that one because that's new, but on the water ones?
As to the current fee on the drinking water operator certification, same thing. That is a new fee that the enabling legislation for operator certification at that level. Just
all these fees have been passed.
Oh, I see. It's not entirely new, but the way in which the fee is staggered is new. That is what's different. Before, it was strictly a fee on reciprocity application fee, and then it has been changed. The cross-connection piece is what's new.
Okay.
Ms. Shibley's here if you have a follow-up question to that specific fee.
Thank you. Going back to Representative Kotek's question, I know that when Mr. Mason comes up on Wednesday, he'll be able to provide some background on the healthcare interpreters program. It comes out of the work of the governor's racial and ethnic health task force. That's Governor Kitzhaber's task force of several years ago. But also, I think the way that this information is being presented on the Office of Multicultural Health healthcare interpreters program is confusing and not quite accurate. This is a new program, and that's how it needs to be presented as new. New proposed fee and difference from this. It's a brand new program. It's confusing in the way in which it's being presented.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, you're correct. Rather than paraphrasing it as establish, because I was following the enabling legislation that had occurred last May, mm-hmm. You're correct. It would be correct. It would be more accurate to reflect it as being new.
Other questions?
I'm ready.
Well, this is such a large number of fees that it's difficult to kind of get your hands around what they all are supposed to do. So I'm just going to kind of start at the beginning and look at the drinking water program. And there appears to be a bunch of certification fees, and two of them are existing. One's a late fee, one's a reciprocity application fee. The other ones are all new fees. And can you talk to us about who would be paying these fees and what they would be getting?
Senator Carter, Representative Morgan, I think I would ask Gil Shipley to address the particulars of the drinking water program. You're right, it is a new schedule of how the fees are applied through operator certification.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Morgan, for the record again, I'm Gail Shibley. I'd be happy to provide more thorough information for you. But generally speaking, operator certifications, that's paid either by the individual or and then that individual is typically reimbursed by his or her employer water system, or it's paid directly by the water system for their operators. To go through the training and receive a certification.
So was there no certification prior to this?
Madam Chair, Representative Moore, yes, there was, but, and I'm sorry, I don't have the information. I did not bring the information with me that goes through the history of the program. I'm happy
there'll
to provide
be,
that for you.
There'll be other, and I'm more curious about what a cross-connection is.
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, I really wish Mr. Bradley I had not excused him because he could explain it much more accurately than I could. The basic idea is, as you may know, in any sort of building structure, whether it's a house, in this building, any other, there is both gray water, wastewater, as well as potable water. And you want to make sure that those never meet. And yet, there tends to be one piping system, and when you talk about water flow, of course, water pressure is very important to making sure that that water flows in one direction and doesn't back up and go somewhere where it shouldn't go. And so that's literally the back flow that refers to.
Okay. Madam Chair, in view of the time, perhaps we should take up these things when we're in work session on the bill.
Here's what I want to do. What I will do is close the hearing on Senate Bill 5032, open the hearing on House Bill 2193, close 2193, and carry over this bill and 2193 until tomorrow. Is that okay? Yeah. Oh, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, in other words, we'd start with those and then go into public testimony immediately thereafter.
Exactly. Does that work for you guys?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, before we leave, Senator Winter,
and when they return, the question on whether or not the various groups had approved the fee increase, and I didn't get a definitive, and if that definitive isn't there, to come and bring it back to us next time.
I'm sure they will. I'm sure you got the message.
Yep,
thank you so very much. It's been a very good committee hearing, and I appreciate very much the questions.
Would the key to this is